Okay, bye.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression, permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory, today and for future generations. Join Kel, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern, and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern, on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
We're faced with an enemy who are determined to destroy us, and we have no hope in negotiating a peace.
Unless that changes, we are justified in doing anything we can to survive.
I always say I agree with that. But at this point, I think I'm saying we're obligated to do that because we are dealing with a scourge. Oh, and hi. And hello, everybody. Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. I am that infidel your imam warned about. Oh, I hope I get a lot of guests in the chat room tonight. That would be fun to see who's monitoring the Mad Fox. But I hope everybody is having a great week. I hope you had a great week. We're embarking on the weekend. And you know what? We're out of the polar vortex. It is a balmy -3 here today, so I'm quite happy. But I hope everybody is keeping warm. It's been a pretty tough winter. I'm freezing in the dungeon. But you know what? I got evicted from the dungeon because Poppy sold the tower. And so Cal Living evicted me. So now I'm going to be a garden gnome in Poppy's garden. Gosh. All right. I will reveal all later, grasshoppers. But do welcome to the radio show. I'm glad that you're all here. I want to talk to you about something, and I want to explain this. I know a lot of you come here to my program, and believe me, you don't know how appreciative of this I am. I bring up issues of Islam, as everybody knows. And I don't want to feel like a broken record in doing it, though. What I try to do is try to bring you perspectives from other people. Oh, and Bigfoot, he's shipping a fox-shaped garden gnome to Poppy's new address. Thanks, Bigfoot. You know how I feel about Islam, the scourge. I like to introduce this program, the Friday night program in particular, when I'm sitting here by myself and bring you perspectives of what others think. And I have a really, really good one tonight. And, of course, it's Islam. Is it the religion of peace? And you'll note, I put in my show notes that I think we know the answer to that, because the problem of Muslim radicalization has been on the agenda of all nations since 9/11. But here in Canada, we face a unique dilemma because the doctrine of multiculturalism, and everybody knows I hail from Canada. Multiculturalism is supposed to be seen as an intrinsic value to our national identity. Sidebar, if you listen to the East Anglian EDL radio show earlier today, we discussed multiculturalism, and I brought up some, I hope, salient points. But the recent disruption of an alleged homegrown Islamic terror plot has caused many Canadians to ask, how can multiculturalism, which preaches tolerance above all else, be squared with a militant, intolerant creed that demonizes non-believers, and that would be us. This week, the National Post presented a week-long series of articles examining this question. Gordon Nicol, he put this series together, and he examines the claim that Islam is inherently a religion of peace. This article is a few years old, but it is timeless. Multiculturalism, when it was introduced in Canada in 1982, when our Constitution was rewritten, included official multiculturalism. Okay? We all know that not all cultures are equal. We know that. And I'm preaching to the choir again. The problem of Muslim radicalization has been on the agenda, like I say, since 9/11. What about the London bombings of 7/7? Since then, there has been a renewed effort among Muslims in the West to present Islam as a religion of peace. This has come in response to persistent probing of the relationship between Islam and violence. But here in Canada, this issue recently leapt to front pages a few years back when we arrested the Toronto 18. These were the fine folks running around Northern Ontario, the jihad camps. These were the folks that were wanting to storm Parliament and behead our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. Yeah, the Toronto 18. I understand for some Muslims, the rise of homegrown terror has meant an interest in reexamining the foundational texts that extremists have used to justify their attacks. For example, the Quran, the Hadith, the tradition of the Prophet of Islam, what he said and what he did, the Sirah, that is the earliest biography of the Prophet, and the works of Fiqh, and that is Islamic jurisprudence. Some are challenging classical interpretations of these texts. They've been held sway for centuries. What to do with this, though? Let's explore. And I just dropped my phone. My apologies. Let's explore. Is Islam really a religion of peace? When the Quran is cited by Muslims in response to questions about violence, it is often discussed in such a way as to shut down a meaningful exploration of this particular text. There are one or two mild passages that are usually offered, as if these fully represent the context of a scripture containing 6,000 plus verses, but the Quran, literally, recitation, is a collection of diverse materials that include polemic, praise, etashali, law, narrative, battle calls, and details of the domestic life of the Prophet. Now, in particular, the source book contains a great deal of material. It relates to violence. This particular article in which I'm citing, it will review that small parts of the material in that they are directly relevant to any debate about the link between Islam and terror, and that is the commands to fight and kill. Yeah. This is the so-called Holy Quran, the dictate to fight and to kill. Do you know that in the Quran, it contains 5 commands to kill and 12 commands to fight, literally, try to kill? Most are found in the second verses, 190, 191, 193, 244, and in the fourth verse, 76, 84, 89, 91, and in the ninth verses, 5, 12, 14, 29, 36, and 123. Those are the sirahs. Brother, that doesn't seem too peaceful to me. Now, the commands, they address a number of different situations, from fighting those who fight you to fighting totally. The objects of the fighting and the killing include the unbelievers, the associators, which would be the Mushrikun or polytheists, and the friends of Satan. In classical Muslim discussions of these verses, two verses attracted more attention than any others. They came to be known as the sword verse. Chapter 9, verse 5, and the verse attribute. Chapter 9, verse 29. Now, if you're familiar with what I do around here on Blog Talk Radio with my radio programs, you also know I do a Monday program with Tim Burton, and our opening song is chapter 9, verse 29. That's what we're talking about. An all-encompassing chapter devoted to defeating the infidel with their jizya and their allowances on whether or not you can repair your church. Well, you can't. If it falls into disrepair, no, you can't. The allowances to build your home above that of a Muslim, well, we know that's not allowed because 929 says so. Islam is oppression. That's what Islam is. So the religion of peace? I very much doubt it. What about the issue, though? When you're talking with a Muslim, and this is not a Muslim bashing show. This is an Islamic bashing show. When Tim and myself interviewed Pamela Geller over there at the Freedom Loving Infidels last week, or earlier this week, I should say. She said that this has nothing to do with the Muslims, but it has everything to do with Islam. She feels the most persecuted under Islam are indeed the Muslims, and she's right. But let's discuss the verse attribute. Chapter 9, verse 29, the verse attribute. It concerns the people of the book, generally understood by Muslims to be faith communities possessing a scripture, especially Jews and Christians. The command is to fight those who have been given the book until they pay the tribute or the jizya out of hand and have been humbled. The command in the sword verse, and that is chapter 9, verse 5, is to kill the associators, or mushrikun, wherever you find them, and take them, and confine them, and lie in wait for them at every place of ambush. At face value, therefore, polytheists appear to be at greater risk than Jews or Christians. Wow. You know, the Arabic verb in all of these verses is not the verb related to jihad. Rather, it is the verb qatala, in its first to kill and the third to fight, try to kill form. Let me repeat that. The Arabic verb qatala, in its first to kill and third to fight, try and kill. The Quran contains many other verses using forms of qatala, which, though not imperative, they appear to encourage fighting or killing. Among these is chapter 61, verse 4. Allah loves those who fight in his way. These are commands. These are commands. But what do they mean? That is, of course, a matter of interpretation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Those who want to give a peaceful interpretation to those verses face challenges from both the classical medieval Muslim consensus and the interpretations of popular figures within the 20th century Islamic revival. I find that very interesting, 20th century Islamic revival. Does such a thing really exist? Come on. There are revivalists out there. Dr. Zudi Jazer, he's a revivalist. And he has a fatwa put on his head. Mm-hmm. God. Muslim scholars have produced lively commentaries, or tafsir, on the verses of the Quran from the second Islamic century up to the present. Now, the earliest complete commentary on the Quran was written by Muqtakil ibn Saliman. He died in 767 AD. Muqtakil seems to take the command to fight and kill at face value. Muqtakil, Sirat Rasul Allah Ababin Ishad, and Muqtakil. They take these commands at face value. If they're taking these commands at face value, what is the adherent doing? Walking away from it? I don't think so. They have no choice. If you're a Muslim, you're in it all the way. And that is the scary thing, though, in that the adherents are taking this at face value. This is why I don't trust Islam, and I don't trust the adherents. I pity the adherents. I pity the Muslim. It's unbelievable, because one of the interpretive principles that Muqtakil and later commentators used was to link passages in the Quran with events in the story of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. And you know what I think about Muhammad. Most fucking you had. These events are arranged in a continuous narrative in the Sirat Rasul Allah of Ibn Ishaq, who died in 767, like I say. Two of them died the same year. Interesting. We had our little friend Suleiman die the same year. Yep. Mm-hmm. You know, Muslim scholars assigned each of the Quran's 114 surahs to initial recitation by Muhammad in either Mecca or Medina. And within these main divisions, they gave each surah a place in a definite chronology, the establishment of which a chronology permitted the concept of abrogation, by which recitation originated later in time took precedence over apparently contradictory passages recited earlier. Now, if you listened to Tim and myself on the Monday show, Tim brought up a very good point. He said, if you're talking to a Muslim about the religion of peace, and they're trying to convince you that it is indeed so, well, From what are they citing, the Meccan verses or the Medina verses? And thus the abrogation. Because the recitations, they originate, and later in time, they're changed, and they contradict the passages recited earlier. Now, sidebar here, if you read the Quran, it's very, very interesting. It's totally out of order. It's not chronological at all. They take the shortest passages and they lead into the later passages. When you read the Quran, you come across the violent passages, but when you're done reading it, you get the peaceful passages. And you walk away thinking, oh, well, hey, maybe this, you know, maybe it is a religion of peace. Well, you know, it's not. If it's a religion of peace, it certainly has been hijacked. I think that's one we can agree on. What about the classical Muslim understanding that developed from these principles? Their understanding was that the commands to fight and kill could be arranged chronologically in the Prophet's lifetime, from the initial permission Muhammad gave to his followers to fight, to instructions on defensive warfare, to conditional aggression, to open unrestricted warfare, as the Prophet's forces grew stronger later in life. Peaceful passages in the Quran were considered to be superseded by materials with a warlike tone. Look that up in Sirah 9. David S. Powers, he is a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Cornell University. He has noted that Muslim scholars of abrogation such as Ibn Salama, who passed away in 1020 AD, claimed the sword verse cited above, like I say, chapter 9, verse 5, has abrogating power over 124 other verses, including every other verse in the Quran, which commands or implies anything less than a total offensive against the non-believers. There was an historian who was born in the United States. His name is John Wasborough. He found that the sword verse became the scriptural prop of a formulation designed to cover any and all situations which might arise between the Muslim community and its enemies. Total adherence. It's exactly what it is. The sword verse. I don't want to bore you with a whole lot of scholars and this and that and the other thing. I'm a layperson. I'm not a scholar. I'm just here to give you more homework, like I say. But pay attention to this sort of stuff because it's complicated. I know. Believe me. But there are little nuggets here that we can absorb. And we can walk away with and study on our own later on. Like, because in my opinion, the greatest threat we're facing today is indeed Islam. But there are influential scholars and authors out there such as Abid El-Salem Farad, Milana Madudi, Syed Kitab. They have all expressed their agreement with the classical interpretation of the commands to fight and kill. What about this? There's a famous illustration of this Islamic tendency, and this is pre-9/11. These are communiques of Osama bin Laden, his declaration of war of October 1996 makes prominent use of Quranic commands to fight and kill, his jihad against Jews and Crusaders of February 1998 opens with the sword verse, and he applies it directly to those he considers to be the modern enemies of Islam. If you do a quick Google of the sword verse, you'll get quite a few hits. I think this is one in particular I want you to take away with you, is the sword verse. Chapter 9, verse 5. But holy smokes, the verse of tribute. Wow. You know, one of the greatest challenges facing peace advocates in Muslim nations is that the Islamist voice that seems to have the greatest appeal to youth are those that portray the Quranic commands to kill as clear and unequivocal. Now pay attention to this, folks. This is going on. This is what we have to fear. The greatest appeal to youth are those that portray the Quranic commands to kill as clear and unequivocal. That's frightening. That scares me. We have all these people on the planet adherent to Islam being indoctrinated with this. These Islamists, some of them, they have already carefully processed Western criticisms, and they have deliberately reasserted the classical understandings. And yes, I am relating to you the classical understandings of the Quran. For instance, Egypt Sayyid Qutb, a guiding force of the, come on everybody, say it with me, Egypt Sayyid Qutb, a guiding force of the what? All my listeners get gold stars because they know this. He's a guiding force of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that is from which Al-Qaeda sprang. He wrote that the tendency to interpret the Quran as if it enjoins only defensive war, it's an era of Muslim minds, defeated by the pressure of unfavorable conditions and the treacherous propaganda of the Orientalists. So good old Sayyid, he was taking it to grassroots, baby. That's what he was doing. The thing is, though, this is not the only way of interpreting these texts. There is one alternative, and it's quite common in some faith communities. It might be to decide that these were commands of a very particular set of circumstances, but they no longer apply to modern believers in this time. Ha! If you believe that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell to you. There's another option, advanced recently by the Turkish scholar, is Raphael Balki. And that is to reject the classical interpretations of those commands as a product of the political tensions of the period. Well, how? How do we do that? Oh, brother. Yeah. A set of commands for a particular set of circumstances and classical interpretations for a particular set of a time period in which there were political tensions of that period. So Islam is going to evolve? Oh, okay, yeah, the Crusades. Yeah, we're not engaged in the Crusades anymore, and things are fine out there. So we're going to abandon these principles. We're going to abandon these texts. Not so bloody fast. You see, Muhammad, being the perfect man, was one that had to be emulated. Muhammad wrote these words, well, he did not write them down. He had an interpreter because Muhammad was illiterate. But these were his words. And to change anything he says, and there's a difference between changing the interpretation and abrogation. Let's make that one clear. Abrogation is part of the Taqiyya movement. But outright changing them? Nope. Get yourself a fatwa for doing that. So the advocates of enlightenment, they're not going to get too far. Muslims are not the only scriptural community to face challenges of interpretation, though. Jews and Christians who regard the Hebrew scriptures as the word of God must deal with the conquest of Canaan, the commandment of total Shurim destruction, the violence of judges like Samson, and the bloodshed of kings like David, among many other materials that suggest godly approval for aggressive warfare against nonbelievers. Conversely, warring Christians who accept the authority of the gospel must deal with the apparent prohibition of violence in the teachings of life examples of Jesus. Now, this discussion has been going on amongst Christians at least since the Crusades, when critics were heard to say, that is not in accordance with the Christian religion to shed blood in this way, even that of wicked infidel, for Christ did not act thus. And that's right. That's our grassroots. The Islamic grassroots is immovable because their grassroots is Muhammad. Who put forth these edicts? Now, within the Christian community, there is one interpretive option, and that is to read the Hebrew scripture through the prism of the gospel. And this is according to the gospel. Jesus said that he had come not to abrogate the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. Jesus then immediately replaced the law of retaliation with non-resistance and commanded love for enemies. And that is from the book of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 17, 38, 39, and 44. This way of dealing with difficult materials raises many questions. But it has allowed Christians to pursue pacifism while holding to the authority of the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, here we go. Oh, here, my page jumped. My apologies. Isn't that funny? Yeah. I was talking about sorry, I'm just saying hello to the chat room. Don't mind me. I get distracted by shiny things. People who listen to me often enough certainly know that. Oh, yes. But I was talking about Matthew chapter 5, 17, 38, 39, 44. This way of dealing with difficult materials raises many questions, but it has allowed Christians to pursue pacifism while holding the authority of the Hebrew Scriptures. But unfortunately, the Islamic principle of abrogation runs in the opposite chronological direction in relation to violence. Because the commands to fight and kill in the Quran are considered by Muslims to be amongst the recitations made very late in the life of the Prophet of Islam. And this is at a time when his conquest of Arabia was almost complete. Muslim scholars have been inclined to read the peaceful texts as subordinate to the later ones. See where I'm going with this, guys? Yeah, I think you do. In other words, Muslims seeking to find a peaceful message in the Quran must fight not only the plain meaning of the Quran's text and the current fashion for militancy, but also the arrow of Muslim history. So interpreting the words of Muslim scripture so that they pose no threat to peaceful coexistence with non-believers, thus seems a large challenge. And in view of the high stakes in the world today, it is certainly a challenge worth taking up. And speaking from Canada, Canadian proponent of multiculturalism will have a harder time arguing that traditional Islam is just another peaceful element in Canada's multicultural quilt. That scares me. In that we can't even do that right now. We're making it harder for them. The proponents of multiculturalism really do have their work cut out for them. But still, it's scary. And this article is from Gordon Nickel. Here are some selected verses I'd like to share with you. Fight in the way of Allah, those who fight you. What I'm going to recite are selected Quranic references to fighting and killing infidels. Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 190. And fight, Qatilu, in the way of Allah, those who fight you. Baqarah, chapter 2, 193. Fight them, Qatiluhum, to there is no persecution, and the religion is Allah. Now remember, these are verbs here. Baqarah 2, verse 244. So fight, Qatilu, in the way of Allah, and know that Allah is all-hearing and all-knowing. What about Nisa, chapter 4, verse 76? Those who are believers fight in the way of Allah, and the unbelievers in the idol's way. So fight, the friend of Satan. Surely the guile of Satan is ever feeble. Fight them till there is no persecution, and the religion of Allah is recognized in its entirety. Al-Infil, chapter 8, verse 39. Al-Tuba, chapter 9, verse 12. But if they break their oath after their covenant and thrust at your religion, then fight the leaders of unbelief. It goes on, and it goes on. Muhammad, chapter 47, verse 4. When ye meet the unbelievers, smile. My apologies. Let me start that right over again. Muhammad, chapter 47, verse 4. When ye meet the unbelievers, smite, which is darba. Smite their neck then, when you have made wide slaughter amongst them. Tie fast the bonds. Then you set them free either by grace or ransom till the war lays down its load. We should be very concerned about this. Is Islam a religion of peace? No. It's not. Why is it not? Because they want to kill us. They want the caliphate. Muhammad said he saw a vast universe out there in the east and the west, and Islam should rule the world. Muslims follow this. They engage in the jihad. They engage in the violent jihad, i.e. 9/11. 7/7. Boston Marathon. They try to intimidate through rule of thumb, iron fist, intimidation, and fear. And we're allowing it. I'm going to take a bit of a break for now because I cannot believe I'm virtually halfway through my program. But I want to share something with you after I come back from break. But I do have something here I want to share with you. Now, if you listen to Tim Burton and myself on the Freedom Loving Infidels on Tuesday, we went to break and I played this song. And there was a certain somebody in our chat room who said they liked the original better. Now, I don't like to single people out. Let's just say he has really, really, really big feet. I'll see you guys back here in 5 minutes.
No.
Welcome back, everybody. And just to remind you, you're listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. And we're talking about, is Islam a religion of peace? I think we've pretty much settled that one. But I do want to thank the people joining me in my chat room, and that is Agador, Bigfoot, COG, Doc, DLB, Echo, Eric, Kyle, who's off to the rally tomorrow. He's off to the demo. I have a guest joining me, Machi74005. And moving forward, and I always say last but never, ever least, is my sweet Sue from New Mexico. Thanks, guys, for being here. You take the time out of your otherwise busy days to hang around and listen to the ramblings of a mad fox, and I appreciate that because I like the company. But I also want to thank people that listen in archive, in which I know you do. I am going to switch gears a little bit, and not too much because it's within keeping of the topic at hand. I had an email from Political Islam because I subscribe, and this was written by Bill Warner. Now, I'm not going to delve too deep into it because we're saving that for Tuesday when Bill Warner of Political Islam will be mine and Tim's guest at the Freedom Loving Infidels on the Radio Jihad Network Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. But we all know who Bill Warner is. He's a member of the technical staff in solid state physics at the CERN of Princeton Laboratories, but he also has a lifelong interest in religion and its effects on history. He has studied source texts of the major religions for decades. Now, even before the destruction of the World Trade Center, he had predicted the war between Islam and America. And the day after 9/11, he decided to make the source texts of Islam available for the average person. When he's on Tuesday evening, he's going to talk about his latest article, The Most Despised People in the World. And that is the Christian and the Jew, because nobody is taking care of us. He is also working on a website called The Voice for the Voiceless, and we'll be sharing that one later on as well. But needless to say, Dr. Bill Warner is a sought-out scholar on the issue of Islam. And it's my honor that I was able to talk to him earlier tonight. Here's how it went down, folks. I wrapped up East Anglian EDL radio show with Jeff and his panelists, Tommy and Tim, and I had an hour before I was to come here, and I got to speak with Bill Warner on the phone, and he was making his supper. Hi, Bill. How you doing? Oh, Kel, how you doing? Am I interrupting you? Not at all. But I could hear cooking sounds in the background. I knew he was. But Bill Warner, being the gracious man that he is, he was fine with it. But, yeah, Dr. Warner, he has really delved into the issues of Islam, and in particular, its relationship in the United States and globally. He, like I say, He has a PhD in physics and math, and he has statistical methods that he has applied to the Islamic text that shows that Islam is far more of a political system than a religion. Correct? There is no unmitigated good in Islam for the Kafir or non-Muslim. Correct? Islam's ethical system is dualistic and is not based on the golden rule. Correct! Islamic doctrine cannot be reconciled with our concept of human rights and our constitution. Hello. The great majority, and this is 96% people, of all Islamic doctrine about women subjugates them. Sharia law, anybody? The Sunnah. And this is what Muhammad did and said is more important than the Quran in a Muslim's daily life. Absolutely. Muhammad tells you even how to go to the bathroom, in which hand to use, and how to do it. Can you imagine waking up every morning and you're engaging in your ablutions? Very, very private business. You know, your shower and this and that, and of course the other thing. Very private. But you're conscious that some moon god is dictating how you even engage in that? That's Muhammad. Those are the Sirahs, the Sunnah, rather. And that is not a prospect in which I want for my children, nor do you for yours. So when Dr. Bill Warner started studying Islam and applying the statistical methods to it, I was rather sure. I was rather enthralled. I was rather so happy that we had yet another counter-jihadist expert on our team. I want to share with you what you can expect to hear from Dr. Bill Warner on the Freedom Loving Infidels at the Radio Jihad Network, what you'll hear on Tuesday. This is one of the most wonderful recent things he has put out. Everything he puts out is brilliant. This is his latest. Pay attention to this. He is discussing necessity and obligation, and I will tell you why I'm tying this in with what Tim had to discuss the other day.
There was an event reported out of Halifax, Canada, which can teach us all something about Sharia law and how to deal with it. There was a Miss Powers who was taking an Aikido class. Aikido is a martial art, and it was time for her to test for her black belt. But about that time, the class got a new student, a Muslim student, and since he was a good, observant Muslim, he immediately started making demands of the Kafirs, which is what he's supposed to do. He told the class that the class henceforth would be divided into males and females on each side of the room, and that he would not be sparring with any of the females. Now, this class had, since its inception, been mixed in terms of gender. But for reasons known only to himself, the Aikido instructor said, okay, that's the way it will be. We'll divide the class, and you won't spar with women. When Miss Powers went home and told her mother was incensed. Who had the right to do this? And so she went to different Canadian officials. As a matter of fact, she did this for a year's time. She got no results with anybody. She got the same response from every official. Canada is a multicultural society, and minorities have their rights. And he is within his rights to insist that the class be done this way. Let's step back and look at this. This is really not about an Aikido class, and it's not about Canada. What this is about is Sharia law. The Sharia was being applied here by this Muslim student, and it makes demands on Kafirs that they submit. But what are we going to do with this? Because we have the same things happening nearly on a daily basis here in America. a factory owner is told that, well, we're Muslims and we need to shut down the assembly line because we need to pray. What's he supposed to do? Prison systems are being demanded to serve halal food to Muslim prisoners. What are they to do? Well, it turns out what they're supposed to do is to study the Sharia, to know the Sharia, and realize that the Sharia has the answer to this problem. There is a principle in Sharia, which is necessity cancels obligation. You see, the Sharia is filled with things that Muslims are obligated to do, and one of them, for instance, is to eat halal food and to not eat non-halal food. But here's the way it works. If a Muslim's in a lifeboat, and the only food on the lifeboat is spam, which contains pork, then the necessity of staying alive cancels the obligation to only eat halal food. In short, the Muslim can do what common sense dictates here, which is to eat the pork and stay alive. But that's the answer to the problem. So when the factory worker is told by his Muslim workers, we need to shut down the assembly line, he tells them, no, I am not shutting down the assembly line. Now then, the necessity of earning a living cancels the obligation to do prayer. And by the way, Muslims have been missing prayer since time immemorial. That's the reason why when you look in a Sharia text, it has rules on how to do makeup prayers. It's likewise in the prison system. When the prison system is met by a demand for halal food, if the prison system says no, you can't have your halal food, then the Muslim is relieved of the obligation to eat it. So the answer to Sharia is the proper application of all of the Sharia. And that's the answer. We have to begin to understand the true nature of Islam in order that we can deal with its demands. And once we understand its true nature, these demands can be easily met or not met. We need to know the Sharia. Thank you.
Now, doesn't that... It's such a simple formula, isn't it? And now I'm going to tell you why that clip means everything to me, because Tim Burton brought up the exact same thing. Do not allow the allowances. Do not give in to the demand. You heard what Bill Warner said about the... employer, we have to make provisions for the Muslim. No, we don't. If we stop giving in to their demands, if we stop acquiescing, they're going to get used to it. Oh, and Echo was here, and Echo left. Hey, Echo. Stop giving in to these demands. Stop... appeasing them, because that's the Sharia. That is the camel's nose peeking through the tent and moving in full bore into our home. I like what Tim brought that up. Exactly. Oh, I've got Muslim Sunflower here. Hi, Muslim Sunflower. How are you? There you go. Don't know who you are. I've never seen you before, but it's nice to see you here. Welcome. You see, I think that the problem is that we are engaged in appeasement, and we have to stop that. If a Muslim breaks the law and he goes to jail, or she, could be a Muslima, you never know, and they break the law, they get the chow, like everybody else. No special dispensation. Quit with the halal meals. Quit with the prayer in school. And by the way, just to let you know, Liz Sandals, member of Provincial Parliament, Ontario, Canada, Minister of Education, has still never gotten back to me. Mm-hmm. She's afraid of me. Discontinue with the allowance of Islamic prayer in our public school. monitor the moth. Now, we know that there is radicalization going on in those moths. If there's a Muslim, I don't know, a Muslim sunflower, if you're a Muslim, please call into the show. The call-in number is 347-237-4318. Or you can scroll to the very top of the chat box, and there is a skippity skype button there. You can go there. But if there's a Muslim out there that would like to talk with me about this, I'd be more than happy to. But I actually do have a caller on the air right now, and this is Matt for America. And Matt, hello, how are you tonight? Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. How are you doing tonight?
Doing very well.
That's good. That's good. You know, the one thing about Islam, and especially Islam in America, that I just don't understand are the common pictures that we as Americans, and I'm talking left and right, we all see the same pictures. And one of the common pictures is a woman dressed to her eyeballs because, and it's all the time, it's not just some of the time, they're dressed to their eyeballs because they're not allowed to dress any way else. But yet we call this a religion of peace. We call this a religion of understanding. What is the deal with people understanding what the true cause and belief is behind Islam? I mean, in this country, you can't treat women a certain way, which I think is correct. I mean, they should be considered as equals. And when you're talking about Christianity or any other faith that goes against Islam, you're going to be condemned for it. I can't tell you the last time that I've had a conversation with an Islamist where they have agreed with me with any of my religious beliefs, where they haven't wanted to be violent with me. So when are people going to get it with what's presented directly in front of them? It's non-biased. This presentation is non-biased. When are they going to get it?
They're not, and that is what worries me. And as I was reciting in the article, there are so many surahs and hadiths in here that talk about the commandments, which is literally to kill. And if you confront them with you, they'll offer you the Meccan, the more peaceful passages, but they leave out the Medina. Actually, I think I got that backwards. I'm not too sure. Let me straighten that out because I sound like an idiot if I don't have it right. But what they'll do is that they will cite the more peaceful passages, and they'll leave out the more violent passages, and they'll try to convince you that Islam is indeed a religion of peace, in which we know it's not, because I am debunking that right now on this program. We are all debunking that notion on all these radio programs. And Matt, you bring up a really good point in that when you talk with somebody and they try to convince you, what I'd like for you to do is ask them why the burqa, because that's not in the Quran, that's not dictated in the Quran. That's one thing, actually, that Muhammad did not dictate. Women do not have to dress head to toe in a hefty bag. Maybe ask them that.
Oh, you know what? That's what I'm getting at. What is right in front of the entire American public right now? As a matter of fact, it's been in front of us for quite some time. If you remember, there was a Time magazine cover not too long ago. Well, it was a long time ago. That's why I'm bringing it up. It was in the early 90s, and it was a very famous picture of a woman in Afghanistan. And she was dressed from head to toe in Afghan garb, in the burqa, and only seeing the eyes. And it was a very famous picture of what Islam was all about. That's what it was. It said, this is Islam. And I'm thinking to myself, if there was any picture of oppression that you could point at and say, this is a religion of oppression, that would be it. I mean, what else do you need? I mean, do you actually, we've seen you know, things in the news. We've seen little video clips in the news of people getting stoned, you know, or hit with rocks, and we see these stories all around. What the hell do people – you're really going to let this into your country? Not you, not your listeners, but possibly some of the listeners that are coming by saying that you're crazy. You're going to let this into your country? You're going to let your daughters – I got a 10-year-old daughter, man. She's 10. You're going to allow your daughters to become subject to this kind of BS? Are you kidding me? It's so enraging.
Matt, you bring up something that is almost like a wow to me. You brought up that Time magazine cover, and that was many, many years ago, right?
Yeah, I would have to say at least 15, 20 years ago.
Yep. And back then, we had a modicum of decency in which we would expose that. And now, look at where we are. Fast forward to 2014. And what does Rolling Stone magazine do? They put a photo of Zohar Tsarnaev on the cover and make him look like a rock star. Like, are we going backwards, or what is going on with us, with our line of thinking when it comes to dealing with the issue of Islam? Back then, we denigrated it. I think now, because of the power that Islam is wielding, whether it be civilizational jihad or otherwise, the hold that they have in the United Nations, we're simply afraid. Rolling Stone magazine, when they put that photo up of this little shithead who killed 3 people and wounded 250 others. And I'm sorry, I just dropped a word there. I'm sorry, Matt. I meant no offense. It's just,
that's okay.
Like, we're not really progressing when it comes to the so-called war on terror. It's not a war on terror. It's a war on Islam. This is what we're facing. And our politicians, they refuse to acknowledge that, and that our certainly the mainstream media will not acknowledge that there is a problem out there within Islam.
Well, you know, it's a matter of control. It's a matter. It all ties in. This is all dominoes. You could talk about Islam all you want. It's all part of a grand scheme of globalism. And unfortunately, with where our president's head is, Islam has a lot to do with that. I don't care what anybody says about his quote-unquote Christian beliefs. This is a domino effect. And unfortunately, with Islam and all of these things that we're accepting now is all part of the grand scheme. And we call it progressivism here in America because that's what it's recognized as. It's a whole globalist idealism, which is another thing that our president is involved with. However, he tends to side with the Islam faith, which some people would say I'm full of it, and some people wouldn't. But what do you know? It's so enraging when you look at all the pieces over the last, I'll say, at least 75 years, and you look at the way that they've come together, and they've come together perfectly because all these people that are accepting of these religions that they're calling peace. Yet we're watching and witnessing all the violence and downfalls in the Middle East that are because of this Islam faith. We're witnessing it. We see it. You even see it on MSNBC. They run the stories. They run the stories, but they don't point their finger at it and say, this is Islam. This is the problem.
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, they go out of their way to say that it's not Islam. This is not Islam. This is not the religion of peace. We saw that in May of 2013 when Lee Rigby was slaughtered in the streets and the perpetrator, Abadology, he was standing there with the meat cleaver in his bloodied hand and he was reciting passages from the Quran and he said, yeah, this has everything to do with Islam. And then the Prime Minister, David Cameron, he comes on the next day and says, oh, this has nothing to do with Islam. Like, what are we to do,
like
Matt?
It's just like Fort Hood. It's just like Fort Hood. That was dismissed as a non-Islamic move, too. I'm sorry, the guy was an Islamist, and he was yelling Islamist phrases as he was doing his dirty deeds. And we accept this in this country as normal now. I got to tell you.
Oh, exactly. And a red flag. There were so many red flags with Neto Hassan, a major, a former major. And I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen of the military, I retract that. I henceforth will just refer to him as Neto Hassan. There were warning signs all over the place about this person in his business cards at the very bottom. It said SOA, Soldier of Allah. Like, come on. I mean, that's Muslim Brotherhood, left, right, and center. That's a red flag, and nobody caught it. And he was giving lectures, and he was talking about the virtues of Sharia and denigrating the involvement of the U.S. Military in the Middle East. And people were going to their superiors, and they were saying, look, we have a problem here. And, well, we know what happened next, didn't we?
Yeah, you know, and unfortunately, we're starting to celebrate this a little bit too much in this country. I saw The Butler not too long ago. Did you see that movie?
I have read a lot about it. Is that the one, that's the one about the Butler in the, was it the Bush administration?
No, well, actually, he was a butler through everything through, not FDR. It was everything through Kennedy, actually before Kennedy, up through the Reagan administration.
Right.
He grew up in the civil rights era. Actually, before he was born in the 1920s, he witnessed his father get murdered by a white man. And it was the story of a black man. It was a good story up until it started to reach the end. And the end of the movie was all pro Obama. I'm seeing it. I'll tell you what. And this goes off the Islam track a little bit. But I'm telling you what I see in this country. I am seeing how can I put this? I'm seeing a very pro feeling. I don't want to say feeling isn't a bad thing, but I'm seeing a very play on feelings. Okay. This guy, first of all, in The Butler, the story was all messed up. It had nothing to do with Obama or nothing like that. Okay. It was a push for a certain idealism with The Butler. And there's been quite a few other movies I've seen that were either pro-Islam or, you know, they kind of leaned in that way, made you feel bad for the Islamists, or they made you feel bad for certain people to make the current administration look good for what they're pushing. I've seen a lot of movies like that. The way things are going in society right now, and especially popular society with movies – or something to that effect, is pushing these ideals of what we're seeing coming up with Sharia law. It's actually preparing us for it. And it's very disturbing to watch. If you watch any of these movies or you watch any of these news documentaries or watch Discovery or History Channel, it's all pushing in this area. It's actually accepting it. It is so disturbing, so disgusting. And it's going to ruin America if people do not wake up and say, this is not what our founding was about.
Matt, you just nailed it. You nailed it right there. And one salient point that you made is that it's like they're gearing us for it. It's almost like something, well, it's here, get used to it, we have to prepare. That is frightening, and that's what I see happening. And when I see organizations like the Council of American Islamic Relations and the Muslim Student Association getting involved with politics, this is what I call the political jihad, the civilizational jihad. I always say that we can handle the violent jihadists. We can deal with them. We can take them out. But it is those that come here and use our very own laws against us to get their way.
That is the bigger threat. That is absolutely correct. You could deal with the violent outbursts because you can see it. You can deal with it physically. But when they go behind the scenes and try to change their own laws against you, that's where it gets dangerous.
It is. And what they're doing is that they're changing things. They're changing our traditions, and they're changing our way of life. And Bigfoot just put a link in the chat room, and this is segueing right into my very next topic. Matt, if you would like to sit with me, you're more than welcome to. But I was going to move into this topic, and this is, there's a Christian college. It dropped the name Crusader, the nickname, to bow to global society. And this is from Fox News. And Matt, listen to this, A Christian college in Wisconsin is dropping its Crusaders nickname after nearly 50 years, claiming the moniker has become outdated in a more global society. And this is what the university officials told Fox News. Maranatha Baptist University in Watertown and its Division III athletic teams have used the name since its founding in 1968. Matt Davis, the university's executive vice president, said no complaints have been received by the school and stressed that it coincides with its name change from Maranatha Baptist College in December. So why are they dropping the name Crusaders? And I like Bigfoot. He's an alma mater. His alma mater is Notre Dame. And at they're changing things there as well. Like, what is going on? We are changing so much. This is unbelievable, Matt. Why change the name, the nickname Crusaders? Oh, would that have anything to do with the Crusades against the Moors throughout history? What do you think, Matt?
Well, you got to look at what's in power too. What's the globalist nature? It's all part of globalism. You already mentioned that in what you read. And if you're going to talk globalism and you're going to talk being able to fund some of these schools, which is what these schools look for, is funding, then you obviously have to follow in lockstep. So they're going to follow in lockstep to get whatever funding they can. Any programs, any ideas that come in, certain entities or organizations feel you should be partaking in, you're going to partake in order to get that funding. And I think that's what it's all about, especially when you're talking about a public school, even private schools. But it's all about funding, and it's all about going along with the globalist idealism. And that's what we're seeing with what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to offer a correction, is that Notre Dame High School in Elmira, New York, they are not changing their name. And thanks, Bigfoot, for that. But this particular Christian college in Wisconsin changing, dropping their nickname, Crusaders, that really disturbs me. Yeah.
Well, disturbing. It's disturbing. Mm-hmm. You see it all over the place. I mean, we haven't changed any names here in my current school district, but we're seeing all kinds of changes left and right. Where, you know, my kids, thank God, they come home and they're scratching their head like there's something wrong with what they're being taught, and there is. And I have to, it's a daily process of having to correct them of what they're being taught.
Oh, Matt, you're a man after my own heart, because I'm always on this. I talk about children and the public education system. And I always stress to my listeners that if you can, I know it's very expensive and it's unfeasible for a lot of people, because we do live in an era where people, both parents have full-time jobs, because that's how we're putting food on the table now. But if you could homeschool your children, or at least get them in a private school, or at least what you can do is just be more active in your child's career as a student, because it is a full-time job for them and it should be a full-time job for you. Just know what you're doing.
And that is absolutely correct.
We were talking about, for example, not too long ago, I cited a story about, I think she was in grade 10 or grade 11 in the United States, and she came home from school, and she was taking a religious course, or I don't know exactly what the name of the course was, but it had something to do with either world religions or world politics. And there was a segment in that curriculum, in which the girls dressed up in burqas to understand what it's like to be a Muslim and embrace Islam. Islam, the religion of peace. And she didn't tell her mother. And the mother was talking with one of her neighbors and said, "Do you realize what they're teaching your daughter in that course?" And the mother said, "No, I have no idea." And so the mother asked her daughter. And the daughter said, "Well, yeah, we're learning about Islam right now. It's part of the curriculum. It's part of the syllabus." And the mother said, "Well, how does that make you feel?" And the daughter said, "Well, we're understanding that Islam is a persecuted religion, and we're learning to embrace it." That is the brainwashing. That's the indoctrination.
So she learned that Islam is a persecuted, I'm sorry, say that again, a persecuted what, a religion? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, it's a minority religion, and it's being persecuted in the United States. And
okay, so it's a it's a minority religion being persecuted. Yet she has to dress foot to head in clothing with only her eyes showing, and that's not persecution in any way, shape, or form.
Absolutely, and the mother was flabbergasted, and she. Not being well-versed in Islam herself, she started studying a little further and talking with her daughter and saying that you have to understand what Sharia law is, my dear daughter. But this is what I mean. If parents do not keep on top of what is being taught in their child's school classes, this is what you end up with. If that mother had not been apprised that this was going on in her students, her daughter's classroom, it would have slipped underneath the radar, and that daughter would have still been walking around with the mindset that Islam is okay, it's fine, no problems here, nothing to see here, move along, folks. This is it, Matt. This is what we're facing.
Well,
and they
you know
slip
what?
It's
worse than Islam is fine. Islam is just a religion. They actually are teaching it in schools that it's being persecuted, and it's a horrible thing that it's being persecuted. So actually, the way that they're teaching it in schools is way worse than just teaching Islam, right? Because you're showing it as a religion under attack.
Oh yeah, there's a lot, and it's not just restricted to the United States. It's happening in Canada too. I brought it up earlier that we have an issue at Valley Park Middle School in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. It's a public school, my tax dollars, and that they shut down the cafeteria and they turn it into a mosque, and we call it the Mosqueteria. And the reason why this particular high school went along with having allowances in that they would bring in an imam to lead the Friday prayers. And what was happening was that they were shutting down the cafeteria so that other students could not go to the cafeteria. That's one example. There's another example just out of the UK right now. There's a gentleman named by the name of Razwan Ul-Haq, and he is supposedly an artist. And he is teaching about art, and what he was actually doing was prophesizing the students. And the school didn't let the parents know that this guy was hanging around and that he was prophesizing. He was supposed to be there as an arts director and speak about Islamic art, but what he was actually doing was talking with the students in that Islam is a religion of peace and this is why you should follow Islam, and he was citing Sharia and all sorts of nonsense, and the parents had no idea. Public schools, Matt.
I only know what's been presented to me, and what's been presented to me as far as public schooling goes is we haven't had this Islamist push yet, but we have some pretty serious organizations like Common Core has come into our area, and we also have something called International Baccalaureate. If you haven't heard of it, look it up. It's just like Common Core. As a matter of fact, it's a lot worse. And I'm dealing with those type of things, but when you start saying, well, you know, Okay, let me start again. Let me put it this way.
Go ahead.
If a leftist comes at you and says, you know what, there is no room for religion in school. You've heard that before, right?
Yeah.
Then why are they pushing
sure
religion
have.
In school? Why are they pushing religion in school? Can anybody answer? I'm serious. If you're going to come in
no.
and say religion is no place for school children, you cannot go in and pray. That is just completely unbelievable, and it's not a place for school children to go and pray. Religion is not does not have a place in school. Then why are you pushing religion in school?
Well, you know, I can't pray. I mean, my kids my kids are Christians. They can't pray in a public school on a Friday afternoon or on a or anything like that.
Right.
They if I was Jewish and my kids were Jewish, they certainly wouldn't be allowed to. But what's happening is that these Muslims they're pushing their weight around. And they're making demands. As a matter of fact, Eric Kyle from the chat room brings up a really good point. And Eric hails from the UK. And there was an incident, yet another incident with a public school. And this was a school in that, let me see, I'm just trying to bring it up and... find out the name of the school. Littleton, it is Littleton Green Community School, and they were to attend a workshop called Explore Islam. A lot of parents had some complaints about that one, and they said, no, I mean, I don't want my kid going to that. So the headmistress, her name is Lynn Small, she wrote a letter to all the parents about this multicultural school trip, and she stressed that if they did not attend this workshop without a doctor's note, they would have a racial discrimination note put on their permanent school record. See? You can't even hold your kids back without threat from the school administrators coming after your children.
And you're right, yeah. And that's the way it looks. But again, I would have to say that we need to use their same argument against them that they use against us. I'm sorry, unless they come up with the same program that you just mentioned about learning about mm-hmm. Islam, if there's not a similar program about learning about Christianity, I have to say that why are we teaching our kids just like the left say, okay? The left says, let's keep religion out of schools. I agree with that then. Let's keep religion out of schools, period.
Absolutely,
period.
Absolutely. I mean, why not? I remember when I attended public school way back when we went to our homeroom, the first thing that would happen is that we would sing the Canadian National Anthem and God Save the Queen because we are a Commonwealth of the UK, and then we would recite the Lord's Prayer. Now, of course, due to multiculturalism, which I had discussed earlier in the program, all of that has changed. We have pretty much thrown away the core culture in the host countries in that we're allowing all of these multicultural backgrounds to, I call it infiltration, and we're making allowances for them. But the biggest one that is really making an impact and a huge threat, of course, is the culture of Islam. And I don't call it a religion. It's a cult to me.
Well, it is. But you know what? They call it a religion. And I say, let's call it a religion. I think we should hold on to that. I think we should call it a religion because that's what they use against us. They say you cannot bring religion into our schools. We can't bring religion into our families. We can't bring – when it comes to Christianity. So I say, let's call it a religion. Okay, you want to call it a religion? I'll call it a religion. You better do the same damn thing that you're demanding of us. And then we'll see how well that works.
The problem is that if it's a religion, they enjoy all the protected status that other religions do. And this is what I'm fighting for. I'm fighting for to see Islam de-indexed as a religion and get rid of their special status and get rid of their funding. If we can de-index Islam as a religion and recognize it for the political cult that it is, we can shut down, we can dry up a lot of these groups, the Council of American Islamic Relations and so on and so forth, and we can get the political out of our schools. For example, the last one that I cited, not only Valley Park Middle School in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, but the students of Littleton Green Community, they would not be facing a black mark on their school records for not attending these ridiculous workshops like Explore Islam Day. Like this is just, it's nuts mess. It's just, it's got to stop.
Right.
It's got to stop. And the one way I see of doing that is to de-index it.
Right. They dance both sides of the line, and I understand that. And you're right. You're absolutely right. However, I was just going with the why can't we be two-faced like they are and call it a religion when we want to and call it not a religion when we don't want to. Listen, dear, I got to get moving. You keep doing what you're
Me
doing.
Me too. Matt, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, and believe me, you are always welcome to call back in and sit with me and have a discussion with me, because believe me, I think you and I would never run out of anything to say with each other.
No, it's a lot of fun.
The listeners have been so busy in the chat room. It's just absolutely phenomenal. Matt, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, too, and you keep doing what you're doing and keep moving America in the positive direction like you're doing right now. I appreciate it, dear. You have a good night.
Thanks, Matt. You too, and I will. And ladies and gentlemen, that was Matt for America joining me on the line, and I want to thank him very, very much. That was probably one of the more phenomenal calls I've gotten in quite a while, and I appreciate that very much. When people call in, sometimes I never know what to expect, but believe me, when I get people like Matt calling in, it sure makes it worthwhile for me. But holy smokes, I am down to my last 20 minutes, and I did want to do something here. I have a very, very dear friend, and we know her as Rockstar in the chat room. And she does a lot of work for our military. And I'm forever grateful to her. Her name is Allison. We know her as that. I want to play a clip. This is what Allison, our rock star, does for our troops.
For many of our vets, the real battle is only beginning. With high unemployment, post-traumatic stress disorder, and life-altering injuries, coming back to civilian life can be a difficult journey. We can't wait for the government to solve the problems our veterans face. We must help those who have given so much in defense of our freedom. Unforgotten Heroes is an organization dedicated to assisting our veterans in whatever way is needed in their transition back to civilian life. Please visit unforgottenheroes.org to find out what you can do to help. You can also find Unforgotten Heroes on Facebook. And remember, no hero should ever be forgotten.
And let's be that a hero to save us. I'm not going to stand in the way. I'll hold on to the wings of the eagle. Watch him go.
So thank you, Allison, for all the work you do for our troops, our men and women in the military. I should actually also share with you something else, and I think you all know this, but I am the producer and one of the panelists at this very fine radio program.
If you are sick and tired of listening to the lies you hear from politicians and the mainstream media about Islam, and you want to hear the truth about the crimes that are committed in its name in your country and all around the world, then please tune in to the East Anglian EDL Radio Show on blogtalkradio.com on Thursdays, Fridays and Sundays at 8:30 GMT and 3:30 EDT. For analysis, updates and news about Islam without any of the lies and political correctness that you hear in the mainstream media, and for updates, news and information about the English Defence League, then come and join us on Blog Talk Radio. You can also listen to all our previous broadcasts at any time by visiting the East Anglian EDL Radio Show archive. The East Anglian EDL Radio Show, the official radio show of the English Defence League.
Now, I'm going to close out this show, and I have been discussing, is Islam the religion of peace? I think we can all come to the conclusion that no, it is not. But I want to leave you with a few thoughts. Like I say, I just want you to listen to these radio programs and educate yourself, but Islam is not a religion of peace. Islam is a cult of hatred and conquer, that they want to conquer us. It's Islam, they lie, they cheat, they steal, they murder, they kill, they submit their women, they engage in the demitude, they hate the West, they do not believe in progression, they do not believe in moving forward. The Muslim prayer itself is sick. You know, in Christianity and Judaism, we pray for peace and love and betterment for our fellow men, whereas Muslim prayer, they want us killed. And this is what they pray for 5 times a day. It is the most violent religion, quote-unquote. I'm using air quotes there. They have no interest and assimilating in the West. I know there's a lot of Muslims out there, and they want to live in peace, and they want to be assimilated, but there is one thing you have to keep in mind. Islam, when it's a minority in any given Western country, they're very nice, and they're very fine, and they get along, and they smile, and they bob their heads. But when it becomes an Islamic majority, what happens next? We have seen what's happened in the Middle East. We saw what happened in Lebanon and Jordan and what happened in Iran. These were Christian majority countries not too many years ago. Well, many, many years ago. But Islam moved to town. I want to ask you something. Ask your neighbor. Ask your coworker. Where will the Muslim be when Islam comes to town? We don't know. Are we going to end up with a scenario where a Muslim majority takes over and the imam demands his adherent to slaughter the Christian neighbor that adherent had known for 20 years, and the adherent says, no, I'm not going to do that. They're good neighbors. I've known them for 20 years. And the imam says, you must. Otherwise, we will slay you and your family. That is a reality. That is Islam. I'm going to close out a little bit early because I'm going over to this guy's place.
The Reactionary Speak Radio Program.
Do I really look like a guy with a plan? You know what I am? I'm a dog chasing cars. I wouldn't know what to do with one if I caught it.
The Reactionary Speak radio program.
I try to show the schemers how pathetic their attempts to control things really are.
The Reactionary Speak radio program.
Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. Oh, and you know the thing about chaos? It's fear.
Friday night, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, here on BTR.
Oh, yeah. And React? My God, that show? He's got the greatest panel on Blog Talk Radio, I swear. This guy, the people that he garners to be on the radio programs are great. I rarely call in, but when I do, I create a little bit of mayhem myself over there. But I am out of here. I'm done because I had a couple of topics. I got through them. I hope that you have learned something a little more today, and I hope you take it with you. When you're around the water cooler Monday morning and you're talking about whatever of the day, please don't discuss American Idol. Discuss Islam and what you learned from one of these programs. And just to remind you, I will be back Monday afternoon with Tim, my Monday co-host, at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our guest will be Paul Weston of Liberty GB. And Tim and myself, we do a program called Freedom Loving Infidels on the Radio Jihad Network at 6 p.m. And our guest then will be Bill Warner. Listen to all these radio programs, like I always tell you. We try not to indoctrinate. We just try to educate. Because believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it is absolute mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Folks, have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday. ¶¶